Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution. At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanti Show.
Talking about music, coming of age, and Mexico with Sylvia Moreno-Garcia.
I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
And obviously our special guest today is Sylvia Moreno-Garcia. Hello, Sylvia.
Hi.
So let's start here and have you tell a little bit about yourself, because you're a new person on the podcast. We've never had you as a guest before, so it's awesome to have you as a first-time guest. But for folks who maybe don't know a little bit about you, maybe tell a little bit about yourself.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for having me, first of all. I'm Sylvia Moreno-Garcia, and I am a Mexican-born author who moved to Canada over a decade ago. And my first collection of short stories called This Strange Way of Dying came out 2 years ago, and it was a finalist for the Canadian Speculative Fiction Award. And now this year, just last month, my first novel called Signal to Noise came out, and it's about music, magic, and Mexico City.
And that is, of course, the novel we're talking about today, because I found out that you had a novel, and I was like, well, you got to be on the podcast now. So it worked out. So I would actually like to start with music, unless, Julia, you would like to start somewhere else.
Nope, I'm good with whatever you want to start with.
Okay, because this book, Signals of Noise, for I think the cover will give away that it's about music. But if the cover didn't do it, a lot of this novel deals with music. And I wanted to start kind of with a more personal question, which is your own personal connection to music, because it seems like that had to have come into this on some level.
Yeah, my grandfather and both of my parents worked in radio stations. They were all radio announcers. So I grew up in radio stations and in, you know, radio cabins and cabinas. And so I got to see the real tapes and what it was like to work in that kind of station. And my dad obviously had, well, not obviously, but he had a large collection of vinyl records. And we had a lot of music around the house because of that. Also a lot of music books, but mostly a lot of vinyl records. And later on when CDs came on the market, also a lot of CDs. So I wanted to write something for some time now that was somehow related to radio and sound. And Signal to Noise is one of the things that came out of that.
So I think that the music aspect and the way it works with the magic is really interesting because of the way that the specialty or the rarity of the records themselves, or in some cases where the record has a connection with people, at least that's the assumption that our main character makes, becomes a crucial part of this. So there is that collecting of records aspect, but of course there's all these scenes where they're going through record shops trying to find records that they can use in their magical process. And I was curious where you came up with the idea of using magic using music as the basis for your not necessarily your magic system, but for their particular use of magic.
Mm-hmm. For as far back as I can recall, in whatever form Signal to Noise existed, the connection between magic and music was always there. I don't remember exactly at what point I decided that the records were going to be magical, but it was so early on that it must have come hand in hand. At some point I must have said to myself, music is magic. And I ran through, with the idea. I don't think I did a lot of planning. It just seemed really, really natural to me, because music in a way is magical. It transports you. It's like a time travel device almost. So I don't remember how I did it, but in general, the general theme of magic and music, they were always intertwined. And then I fixed some things and I tried to figure some ways in which they could, you know, does every record work? Not every record works, and that kind of thing. Those came later on, but the general theme of music is magic. I thought about that really, really way, way back in the early stages of this.
So one of the things that I think was really interesting about this is that you don't just use the things that we would have heard on American pop radio. There's lots of stuff from Mexico, from South America and Central America, and all sorts of other places as well. And I love that because, well, for one thing, my father was from Mexico. So it was about 13 or 14 was the first time I was old enough to really socialize with the other kids who were into their music down there. And I remember going and Luis Miguel being super popular and just sort of being like, I don't really like this. Is this what all Mexican pop music is like? So it was really fun for me to read Mitch's opinionated voice, where she was like dismissive of all of that and had her favorite things. And I was also really excited to see that someone has actually made a playlist that you can watch on YouTube or listen to on Spotify with all of the different songs. So if you're unfamiliar with all of these other songs that she mentions, or really any of the songs, you can go and check them out, which is really interesting. But I wondered, because Mitche is so opinionated about which music she thinks is worthy, how much of that actually goes along with your own taste in music?
With my own taste in music? I have no taste in music. I'm terrible about it. I'm obsessive compulsive, so I will listen to a song for about 50 times before it wears off. And it will be the same song or the same album in succession, and until I get tired of it, and then I will stop and jump to something else. I have a soft spot for 1980s music, and but I have an eclectic and weird taste. I like everything, and nothing in particular at different points. My father is much more precise in his music taste and much more sophisticated, but we have never had music discussions, really. I think because he thinks much more highly of his music taste, and I don't think we would agree on anything, but he does have a more sophisticated palate. He knows a lot about 60s music, for example, and my mother has a terrible music palette. She listens to horrible things, the most terrible things. So I don't have any firm opinions about music like I have about literature or film. So I just kind of, I guess, channeled my father and what he might have said about some of these things.
Oh, that's fascinating. So I've seen a lot of people compare this book to Eleanor and Park and other things like that. High Fidelity is another one, with kind of the narrators who are angsty and a bit jaded and have lots of intelligent, witty banter going on. And I think one of the things that struck me so much about this is that Meche is a really difficult character, because she's not very nice. A lot of the time she does things that are really not terribly nice. But at the same time, I did find her easy to sympathize with. So I kind of wondered what went into your choice to have her be at the center of the story, and how did you approach writing that kind of difficult personality?
A lot of times I don't think I make a choice. It's just, I have this weird thing where I can hear characters' voices in my head, and I know that makes me sound like I'm schizophrenic, and I probably am, but most of the times when I start a story, it just begins with a line of dialogue. That's one of the most common things, where I will hear something in my head, and it's a line of dialogue, and then I kind of wonder, who is this person? So I make more dialogue, and I try to hear who they are. So Meche as a personality, she came up a bit like that. The more I kept imagining how she talked, the more real she became, and she had that very specific kind of personality, and she wasn't very nice all the time. But the other thing is, and I was talking to this about with somebody else, was that I don't think we're all very nice, and I don't know if you remember when you were a teenager, or when I was a teenager, I don't think I was all sugar and spice, and my friends were not all sugar and spice, and sometimes we could be quite cruel, and also as children, and mean, and I think that sometimes, especially when it comes to female characters, we kind of want to sanitize them and make them be almost perfect, and they can't have flaws, and I think that's silly, because the character doesn't need to be nice or even likable for you to want to keep reading about them. They just have to be interesting. And I do think Meche is likable, but she's likable in a real way, in the way friends sometimes are, where they're imperfect, and sometimes you hate them and you fight with them and they do the wrong thing. And especially when you're young, that's pretty common. So I didn't want to shy away from that aspect of her. And on the other hand, I really liked her voice. I liked the way she sounded. That was one of the things that kept me really interested in the book, was the way she talked and the way she sounded. When I hear a character in my head and I start picturing who they are, sometimes the most challenging characters are the most fun to keep listening to, as opposed to ones who are very, healthy inside and very normal, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think that does. And I wanted to actually do a follow-up question to something you sort of said at the beginning about the way in which, the part about the fact that we're, you know, when we're teenagers, we're probably not as shiny rainbows as maybe some of us think we were. I know I wasn't. But I know sometimes people have a somewhat rose-colored glasses kind of look to when they were kids. Like, I was a good kid. It's like, well, maybe a little bit. But there's always that kind of dark side to all of us when we're teenagers, because we're all crazy when we're 15. Or at least I think so. Maybe Julia would disagree.
No, I was mostly thinking about, like, the difference between Meche and Sebastian, or Meche and Daniela, because Sebastian has all of these actually very gentle sides that we see throughout the story, and Meche is a much harder character. And I mean, I liked her, but she is a hard character.
Yeah, and I think she becomes much harder as the story progresses, because there are moments when you see those glimmers of kind of the nice Meche, but I think that they get sort of stamped out a little bit, kind of from her own experiences and to some degree from her own personality. I don't know if that's a fair characterization, but that's kind of how I viewed it.
Mm-hmm.
But to bring up, you brought up Julia, was just perfect, because it was the character of Daniela, which she's the one character who has a serious ailment, which is lupus, which means, of course, she's somewhat limited, and or at least her parents make her believe herself to be extremely limited, and there is some degree of limitation there of what she can do physically. But I found her really interesting as a kind of foil, because Meche is she's a hard character, but she's also, I think, very often very practical. Maybe somewhat a little cynical, but practical, whereas Daniela at times seems somewhat naive. Mm-hmm. And I think Meche mentions that in one of the early chapters, just sort of recalls that moment. Did you see her as a foil to Meche at all, or was Daniela kind of a different developing character for you?
I had two friends in high school that were a bit like Daniela, and one was a girl whose mom kept her on a leash all the time. Like, basically she couldn't date, she couldn't go anywhere, and her mom, even if we went to the movies, kind of like her mom would go with us, that kind of thing. So that was one person that I drew on when I was thinking just about characters. And I wasn't thinking about her. They just came back to my brain, and I was like, oh, I remember that person. And then the other person that I remembered was a girl who had lupus and who was my friend, but she was a much more active character. She was, she was a party girl, but she did have that limitation, where sometimes she would get sick and she couldn't go to school and that kind of thing. So I was just kind of remembering them and, how they were in a way. And I kind of used that to build Daniela. And I, obviously when you have a cast of characters, you don't want everybody to be the same. So I didn't want everybody to be Meche because Meche is a particular kind of personality and a particular kind of person. And I thought that Daniela was a good contrast. And I also remembered, fondly some of these girls and what they were like. And they were very soft and shy. Well, at least the one whose mom was like that. The other one was a bit of a party girl and she was very vibrant, but at the same time she would get ill and it would be very hard on everybody. And one thing that I think sometimes happens with female characters in fiction is that we think if a character is not kick-ass, quote-unquote, if she doesn't have, like, some kind of physical strength, then she is not worthy. She is weak. And so I don't know if this worked out the way I wanted to, but I wanted to kind of show with Daniela somebody who has an inner strength. And it's not obvious to Mitch. I don't think she realizes very much how strong she is until maybe the very end, that this is a very kind and sweet character, but just because she is different from Meche and she's kind and sweet and more subdued in a way, it doesn't mean she's an unworthy character. I think she's still interesting, and I don't think Meche perhaps appreciates her and Sebastian as much as she should when she's young consciously, but subconsciously, I think Daniela's sweetness does make its way into Mitch's life, and it helps her, just like Sebastian helps her deal with things, just her being there. So I wanted to show a character who's a little bit different and who has a different kind of strength, and I just was, you know, reminiscing about some people that I knew when I was younger when I was writing her.
Interesting. It seems like, based on some of the things we've already discussed, that this book in many ways is a very personal kind of book, because it seems like you drew upon a great number of either personal experiences or memories, et cetera. Would that be a fair characterization of much of the book?
Yes, but my fiction in general, I like to draw a lot on my own experiences in one way or the other. I believe in writing what you know.
Okay, that's fair. Julie, did you want to tackle the characters a little more?
Sure. So I also really did agree that Daniela's character comes off as a strong character. She's shy and she's sweet, but she definitely has her own opinions and makes her own decisions throughout the book, and I really appreciated that. I guess what I would like to delve into a little bit more is the way the magic works and the way it's introduced, and the way that Mama Dolores, the grandmother, has sort of influenced some of Meche's learning, because she's always asking her for the stories. And I wondered, A, did you ever have people in your family telling you stories when you were younger? Is this reminiscent of any of that? Or did you just come up with this by yourself? And why did you make the decision to have the grandmother be such an interesting influence in that system?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, definitely. My great-grandmother used to tell me stories, and she couldn't read or write, but I am probably a writer because of her, because she would tell me stories of her youth, and there would always be a fantastic element in all the stories. They were told as though it were real, but she would say, oh, you know, I remember that time when I found a snake with wings, right? And so she was telling me about a time period that was real and many things that happened during the Mexican Revolution, but she was also mixing the fantastic. And I often have grandmother characters in my fiction or older characters in one way or the other because of that, because of my own great-grandmother, but also because of the idea of the importance of oral tradition and family as as a way to transmit knowledge. So I think, for example, there's two ways to acquire knowledge. And one is, for example, if you're learning how to cook, you get a recipe book and you follow the instructions, or you go online and you follow the instructions. And the other one is you just learn by seeing your mom or your dad or your grandmother cooking, and you learn the recipes by being in the kitchen, listening to what they have to say and watching them as they do it. And for me, that other kind of knowledge, the knowledge that you learn in the kitchen while they're doing it, is something that that I grew up with and that I wanted to put in the book, because a lot of time the magic systems that I see in some, not in all the books, but in a lot of the fantasy books, rely on this other method of learning, which is more like, here's the book. You know, you follow the instructions, here's salt, and he, you know, it's very like you do these steps and then this happens, voila, magic spell. And in my experience, that wasn't the way knowledge is transmitted, and also magic knowledge specifically is transmitted, because I also have some knowledge of magic and some spells and things like that that you pass on from mother to daughter and that kind of thing. And those things are not written down. Those are just things they tell you. So I didn't want to have this magic system that was kind of inorganic. I wanted something that was organic and more fluid and elastic, because that's the kind of fantastic and magic that I had when I was growing up.
Very cool. Very cool. So you mentioned that you were a Mexican born and you've lived in Canada for the last 10 years. Were you actually a teenager in the 80s in Mexico?
Yeah, I was a child in the 80s in Mexico. I was a teenager more like in the Nirvana era. I'm a little bit too young to have been a teenager in the 80s.
Okay.
But I was around.
So I was just sort of wondering how much of this 1988 version of Mexico City is actually ripped directly from your memories.
Oh yeah, no, it's some people ask me how much research went into writing this historical fiction, and I kind of laugh because it's not historical for me, it's just what happened, right? I look for doing my research, I did have to go back and check some years, especially for song years and things like that. But a lot of it was phoning my dad and asking him a few things, and also just going through boxes of Polaroids and trying to remember what things had been like.
Fascinating. So, switching gears slightly, you have three main characters, and they have to work together to make the magic happen, and they all kind of approach it from different directions. Did you come into this knowing that you were going to make this work as sort of a group effort, or did you come into it with the idea that music is magic, and then sort of that became the group dynamic later?
I don't think I had. I knew I had three characters at one point, and I knew I wanted them to be working together and doing something together, if that makes any sense. And I thought early on that them doing magic made sense, and not just having Mecha be the only one who does magic, because they're friends and they're sharing something. They're sharing an activity together. I mean, friends do stuff together, right? Naturally, one acquires a hobby and it's really easy for the other ones to kind of be drawn into it, like card collecting or things like that.
Sure, unless it's putting pink glitter all over everything. I think that's pretty much just Daniela.
Yeah, that's her.
Well, each of them has their own hobby, as it were, that they sort of kind of share, but don't really. It's like,
yeah.
I mean, Meche, she's always ahead of her walk, but there's that moment in it when it says, Sebastian sees her and says, you know, well, there she is with her Walkman again, because she just goes everywhere with it. Like, anywhere she is, she's with this darn thing. And then Daniela with, I guess, glitter or maybe just pink things. Lots of pink things come up, which is cute. And Sebastian with books, which he keeps trying to get Meche to read. And she only reads, I think, the one. When she's in Oslo, I believe, which I found really amusing because he keeps getting her, he keeps buying her the gifts, the like one gift she desperately doesn't want, but that's what he keeps getting her. And I just, every time you hear about that, I just kind of grin because I'm like, yeah, that's like my family, only in reverse. Like I ask for books and I don't get them. So, well, actually I wanted to go back to the Mexico City thing, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay, Julia?
Sure.
Awesome. Okay, so there's a moment in it, in the book, where you mention that the city is essentially sinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly had never heard of this until I Googled it and realized that there's some truth to that statement. And I was
hoping... It is sinking.
It is sinking.
Oh, yes, you've never heard of that before. That's interesting.
I'd never heard, like, I mean, I've probably heard, like, stories like, oh, there was a sinkhole in Mexico City. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that happens. You know, sinkholes are, they, you know, weird. And, you know, you hope they don't happen in your backyard. But, you know, they happen. But I did not realize that the city itself is, like, there's a legitimate concern that it's just going to go bloop into the earth. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about that, because it does crop up in the book, obviously not as a major plot point, but it is an element of weird reality that appears in your work.
Yeah, Mexico City is sinking, and it is sinking because it was built upon a lake, and it used to look like Venice about 600 years ago, before the Spaniards arrived in Mexico City. It was a city built upon a lake, and there were no... The people would travel on canoe, basically on boat, from one place to the other. And it functioned very, very well. And there was an agriculture system called chinampa, where they would grow crops, but on the water. And so it worked very well until the Spaniards came and they decided that they were going to drain the lake. And so they did, and they completely changed the ecology and the topography of the city. But that was not such a great idea. When you build something that is, when you build a really big, heavy cathedral over an area that was marshy, it's like in the Monty Python cast, you know, movie, when they say, I built a castle the first time and then it sunk. And then I built the second one on top of it and then it sunk again. But the third time, this time it's going to hold up. Yeah. It's like that. It's not such a great idea to, build upon something that was so wet and watery and marshy. So yeah, Mexico City is definitely sinking. And in fact, in the area where I grew up, right next to my home, they bought a plot of land that was right next to my parents' house and, well, apartment in Mexico City, whatever. Vecindad. It wasn't an apartment. A lie. It's something. Yeah. And anyway, they were gentrifying that area, so they were going to build this really tall tower of condos, maybe like 10 floors or something like that. So they started digging the foundation, and then what happened one day was that they struck something and water started bubbling out, and they couldn't contain it, and it started spilling onto the street, and they had to like bring machinery and pump it out, because it turns out that under that area and also under my home, there's like still these like underground bodies of water, like, you know, ponds or whatever. There's all this water. So they didn't know that because they were terrible engineers, and things like that happen in Mexico City all the time. So yes, it's sinking and there's water underneath, and there can also be ruins and other stuff. So it's a funky city. It's very kind of surreal sometimes. And yeah, when I tell people the story that it is sinking, they don't believe me, but there was this big project to kind of prop the cathedral up, because one side of it was like on firmer rock, but the other part was not. So it was getting like lopsided through the centuries, like every year, like half an inch of whatever would sink, sink, sink. So now the cathedral was like all lopsided. They had to get this big system in and like get this hydraulic system in there to balance it so that the cathedral did not go, you know, like one side of it, whoop, into the ground. So that's Mexico City.
That is so crazy. It's really fascinating, but also crazy. That's yes. Wonderful.
Strange is the solution. Look at the ecosystem that you are going into before you decide to completely change it.
No, I have a feeling the Spaniards weren't thinking very long term, or if they were, long term for them was like 15 years, maybe, not centuries.
Yeah. Well, they were like, we're going to make a big church and it's going to hold because we're Spanish. So, you know.
Yeah. Go good. Churches. They hold up forever, except when, you know, they get bombed or something and then they need to fix them later. But to continue on the city theme, I really did find it interesting, how much attention you put into the particularly Meche, but obviously all of the characters have a kind of turbulent relationship with the city, but Meche in particular because of her family life. And there's a sort of general resentment I think she has for the place she lives. I think at one point she even says she hates the city. I can't remember if it's older Meche or if it's younger Meche, but it may be I think it's the older one who says that. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about kind of building that complicated relationship with the city itself, even if you just would talk maybe just under the relationship it has with Meche.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, all cities, I think, have personalities. I've lived in several cities, and they all do. So, for example, Vancouver is very new, and where I live, and you can feel it, it's almost like a teenager or a child. Everything is new, and you can feel it in the city. Mexico City is an old city. It's older, you know. It's been around for several centuries, and so there's something about it that gives it a different character to it. And it's a complicated city. It's beautiful and it's horrible at the same time. It's very big, 20 million people all together in there, so you can imagine how crazy it can get. And it's very ugly also and very pretty, and it's a city of contrast where you can have slums right next to mansions, and that, you know, happens quite all the time. So I have a complicated relationship with Mexico City and with Mexico in general, and I know a lot of people do. So I didn't want to gloss it out and be like, it's wonderful and great, because it's not all the time, especially when you're growing up and you're a teenager and you hate it there. So I wanted that to be true in the story. And in general, I am ambivalent about Mexico City. It has a lot of problems. And for example, my friends were telling me this week that the subway system, which is very important and very big, they were like, oh, it's crazy. It's getting worse all the time. This week we got on the subway and the doors wouldn't close for the subway. So we had to like hand close them and hand open them at every station. So they were literally opening the doors themselves and closing them at every station so they could get on and off on a subway that transports millions of people every day. And that's the kind of thing that will happen in Mexico City. So I am ambivalent about it. She's ambivalent about it. I think we're all ambivalent about it. And anybody who lives there also has this kind of love-hate thing going on with the city. And that was pretty clear this week when my friends were complaining about the subway system. And then today, another one of my friends was complaining about the government. So, yeah.
Sounds pretty like a normal relationship to a city, I think. Unless you live in that one perfect city somewhere that's, you know, on the Utopia
Island. I think it's in Finland or something like that.
I mean, I think of like New Yorkers. New Yorkers will talk about how great NYC is, but then, of course, they'll also complain about, like, you'll see complaints about the subway, like something weird happened on the subway and it's terrible, or, you know, things that they'll complain about. But at the same time, NYC is the greatest city in the world.
Yes.
So,
of course. No. Like your parents, same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I will say I do not live in a city that I like at all. So
yeah.
My relationship's not complicated. It's very simple.
Okay.
But you know, whatever. So just to talk a little bit more about sort of the characters and relationship to the city. I found it really interesting, and I don't know if this has been a reaction you've had, but. You know, I've never been to Mexico, so I can't speak to having any experience there whatsoever. Julie, I suspect, has been, correct?
Yeah, I've been a few times.
Okay. Oh, okay. Yeah.
I got family down there, so.
Okay, so you may not have had the experience I had, but I found it really interesting that as I was reading this book, how easy it was for me to sort of connect with the experiences the characters were having, even though there were cultural differences. And it's particularly the music. I mean, there were a lot of references to music that I was like, I've never even heard of that person, which just shows how wide-reaching my music listening has gone, and it's something I'm going to have to correct immediately. But I found it really interesting, and I wonder if this is a reaction you've had, that I connected with the characters and their struggles in a very sort of normal way. I don't know if that's the right word to come out of my mouth, but is that something that you've had in terms of people sort of connecting with the characters and their experiences with high school and the horrors that is school?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have liked it and have not felt like it's too hard a leap to make between them and the setting. Of course, I think that if people are willing to read about places where, like Westeros, where there's dragons and a million people and the customs are completely different, then Mexico City shouldn't be such a leap, but sometimes it seems like it is. And wrongly or rightly, publishers and people sometimes think, well, nobody's going to read that because those are Mexican kids. They'll never identify. But I thought readers, they read The Lord of the Rings, they can read this.
That's a really good point, actually. When you say it like that, it's, you're right. You're totally right. Like, what, there's nothing more weird about, well, honestly, there's nothing really weird about Mexico, other than it's sinking. The Mexico yeah. City, that's the only, I guess, the really super weird thing about it is that it's actually sinking.
Oh, there's plenty of weird things about it, but there are plenty of weird things about every other city as well.
Right. I'm kind of getting at this idea that, you know, if I'm going to read about places where dragons are real, which is absurd, but, you know, fun, that's actually a further leap than to say, like, I'm going to read about, like, something set in Shanghai or something, which is a real place. And hopefully the author writing about Shanghai wrote it really well and reasonably accurately, at least as mediated between one's experience as that can be. So that's actually a really good point. So I wonder if I, you know, as I was saying that in my question, I kind of thought, like, I feel like it's a false notion that I had an experience that when I kind of I came to this city and I thought, I'm going to get a different experience, and then realizing that's actually part of the problem is believing that that's what I'm going to be getting, when actually the differences would not have been as pronounced as I assumed. And I think that's a flaw in my own thinking and thinking about this city and thinking like, oh, it's going to be a quote unquote exotic place, mm-hmm. and then realizing I'm an idiot because it's it is a different place, but it's not. It's not that immediate assumption, as I think being inculcated in American culture to some degree, I kind of had that. Julia, obviously, I think it would be fair to say you probably did not have that, having a different experience. But it's a very revealing moment about me.
Well, I did have a different experience because there aren't very many books that actually are set in Mexico that are available on the U.S. market. True. So it was different. It was interesting to me. And I think actually this does tie into something I wanted to ask Sylvia, which is the interesting way that this novel is presented, where it sort of flashbacks to 1988 or 89 and then flash forward to 2009 when Mecha has returned after being gone for quite a while. And when she comes back to the city, she has all of this sort of flood of emotion, which some of it is something that she doesn't want to feel at all, and she kind of seems to want to deny that it's even there. But at the same time, it seems like some parts of the city she's inexplicably drawn to, or some foods bring back memories that are somehow comforting, even though she just really wants to be away and she wants to go back to Oslo. And I kind of wondered, I think that that's something that anybody might feel when I had a friend who joined the Peace Corps, and she put it that whenever you go someplace new, you then set yourself up to leave it and miss it forever, even if you didn't like it while you were there, and that you'll carry it with you. And I thought that was really interesting, and I kind of wondered, especially since you are someone who was born there and then left and went someplace else, and presumably you've returned at some point after leaving,
or at least you talk to your friends who still live there, what kinds of your own connections and things that you miss and things that you wish were gone but somehow also feel familiar went into this?
Well, I miss the food because there's not very much good Mexican food in Vancouver. But on a more serious level, when I go back, one of the hard and strange things that happens is that obviously I've been away for over a decade now. And so when I go back, even if it's every 2 years, a part of my neighborhood has changed and it's continuing to change because it's getting more and more gentrified. It was more of a working class area, and now they're building, like I said, condos and things like that. So when I go back, it's strange to see, for example, that the bakery's gone and now there's a Starbucks, and the place where they used to sell chicken or, you know, poultry is gone. And now there's like a gym. They did open a gym nearby. But it's also kind of funny, the things that remain the same and that do not change. So there's things like, for example, a billboard that hasn't been changed in like 20 years. Somebody left it up there and, you know, it hasn't sold, or I don't know what happened. It hasn't been changed in 20 years. And you go by and it's, you know, this weathered image. It's almost completely faded away from some kind of detergent from 1989 or 1990. And it's still there. And I sometimes think that when I go back and that billboard is gone, it's going to be a heartbreaking moment. I mean, it'll disappear at one point, but it'll be such a sad moment, that stupid billboard. Because the world is changing, right? Every time you go back, it changes, and then you're looking at it and it's kind of like, it's like a ghost image. You superimpose your memories of the place that was into the current place, and you're looking almost at two things at the same time. So it's like when I was a kid, I had these acetates that would show the human body. So you would lift one and then you would see the lungs, and then you would lift another and you would see the skeleton, and you would lift another and you would see the blood vessels. And it's like that. It's like a piece of acetate that is over reality. And it's overlaid over the present, but the past is overlaid over it. And you can't stop seeing it, because even though I see the Starbucks, I'm looking for traces of the old bakery, or I can see traces of the old bakery. You know, the door is the same door or something like that. You know, there's things that are left behind in the city, but at the same time, it's completely changed. So it's like living with ghosts and something like that, I think.
That's really interesting. The word that kept coming up when you were describing the paper layering was the word palimpsest. The way in which cities build up on top of each other, and you can see the remnants of past iterations of the city is kind of the same way, but you describe it as ghosts, which mm-hmm. I find so much more interesting.
Yeah.
So I mean, obviously I find it interesting in that respect too, because Meche, when she returns, I believe the present narrative is set in 2009. The previous narrative is 88, 89-ish. When she returns to sort of deal with the aftermath of her father's death, she makes those observations as well, of things that have changed. But I find it interesting the kinds of stuff that she notices have stayed more or less the same. So she goes to the corner store, and it's not the same man from before, but she assumes it's his son. And he has that same leery eye about particularly kids, but anyone who comes in, like, they're going to steal my candy, which I thought was really interesting. And was that something that you were kind of weaving in from your own personal experience of kind of going back and having not only experiences of seeing the ghosts, but seeing the way in which things have not changed, and the kind of the surprises that sometimes happens when the things you would think would change didn't?
Yeah, the things that change and that don't are always very funny. And also, it's always very funny when you see somebody that you haven't seen for a very long time. And so one of the things that happened recently was that some friends of mine who I had not seen since college came over to visit me in Vancouver, and at first it's a strange experience because you see somebody and they may have changed physically, like they don't look exactly the same. We don't look at the same that we did before. But also you're kind of afraid that you have changed inside. You're not the same person. You don't really know what this person has been up to. You haven't been going to lunch every day. But after a while of hanging out together, just after a few days, we were having some of the same dynamics that we used to have. So in a way, we had changed, gone through more than a decade of our lives. And in another way, we were still the same. And that's, and I think that happens with people that you know too, and with family, is that sometimes some things just stay the same.
And that's something that I really appreciated about the book, because all of the characters have that kind of, they grow and change and they are different, but at the same time, you can see how they're still the same people in the present day 2009 narrative versus the 1988 narrative. And there's even the echo of that in the talking about Mitch's father. Her mother says, you know, oh, yes, he was always going to finish his novel next summer. And when she says it, Mecha kind of realizes that she almost seems fond of him, even though she doesn't imagine that because they had divorced. So she assumed that her mother just hated him. But it's like, yeah, because there was still this charming guy that she fell in love with when she was young, and he hadn't changed so much that he wasn't that person anymore, even though their paths had completely gone in different directions and they weren't good for each other. And I thought that was a really a nice sort of thing to see, because I think that characters, if they're going to be real feeling, need to sort of show us that dimension of change and yet also retain themselves. So I guess that's not really a question, but I thought it was cool that you brought it up with your own friends. And I kind of wonder, this is more personal, have you dealt with the death of a loved one before, and how much, if any, of that went into sort of Mitch's coming to terms with her own father's death?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, my father's alive and he's okay so far. Knock on wood. Let's hope it keeps going like that. My great-grandmother died, and when she died, I was in Mexico. I was visiting for the summer, but I had neglected her very much for the past few years because I had gone abroad. I was in the United States for a few years studying there, and because also after my childhood, when I was a teenager and whatever, I didn't want to be anywhere close to my grandmother. I was ashamed of her. My great-grandmother, because, you know, she used to be a maid and she was illiterate and lots of other things. And you don't want to be hanging out with this, you know, 70-something-year-old lady or 80-something-year-old lady at the movies with your friends. How gross is that, right? And you want to be doing your own thing. So I neglected her very, very much. And then she died one day, right? By the time she died, she was having trouble remembering things. So she would sometimes confuse me with my mother, and sometimes she didn't know where she was. And so I wanted to spend even less time with her. So I've always felt very guilty about that. And I think that one reason why I write anything is because I am constantly apologizing to my great-grandmother in my writing. I will never stop feeling guilty about that.
Yeah, it was really interesting to me reading it. I had a lot of complex reactions to this because my father was from Mexico. He is dead. He died while I was in college. I saw him over Christmas break when I came home that year. But then he died in March. So the anniversary of his death is next week. And, that's been 15 years now. So it's not, you know, as fresh, but it's the sort of thing that I keep kind of coming back to, is like, oh, all of these associations with Mexico, which are inextricably linked with my father. And then there's this woman who's about my age going back to deal with the death of her father. And I'm like, huh, this is bringing up all sorts of really strange sort of like that feeling of kind of guilt because I hadn't talked to him in a few weeks before he died. And like, I remember that the day before I had this thought that I really needed to call him and I was going to do it the next day. And instead the next day I got a call that he had died. And so I always felt guilty about that because, you know, you think, oh, I had that thought that I should have done it, but I should have done it earlier. And lots of different things. I thought it was really interesting to see her struggling. And I think it's, I think it's cool that that's coming from a place of personal struggle that you had, and hopefully that that's actually helping you feel better about your own great grandmother.
There's no closure for me. There's closure for characters because they're characters. but on a macro level, as an immigrant, as somebody who leaves their home country, you always have to, I think, or at least me subconsciously, deal with a matter of betrayal because you left, right? You left the homeland and you left it behind and you left people behind. You couldn't take everybody, obviously. So even when you took, my husband and I emigrated together, but he left his family behind and my dad's in Mexico and all that kind of stuff. You can't take everybody and everything. And I think there's always some guilt in that because you did go. And so at a macro level, I think there's that. And at the micro level, in this particular novel, there's the personal relationship. But at a macro level, I do think that an immigrant is always having to think about that in one way or another at some point.
Cool.
That's really intense.
I mentioned before that some of the reviewers had compared this to Eleanor and Park, which is a YA bestseller from a couple of years ago by Rainbow Rowell. Have you read that book at all?
No, I'm a terrible human being and I don't read YA.
I don't think you're a terrible human being at all. It was just one of those things that reviewers kept bringing up. And I was like, huh, I guess I can see how that they would make that connection. But I was kind of surprised at the same time because in some ways it doesn't feel like it at all. I mean, it does because there are some striking teen characters and they have a really sort of intense relationship with each other. But it's not the sort of thing that I would automatically expect that you had read. But I'm always curious when people say something is so similar to another thing, whether the author has actually read that other thing.
Yeah, no, I don't think I've read any of the things that they have compared it to. So I was like, what's that? But yeah, so I guess that's interesting. But no, I don't read young adult books, generally or at all. If I'm honest, it's not a category that I gravitate to. And, some people just read a specific category, and I have very weird reading habits, and that's one category that I haven't been attracted to. I might have read one or two things just for another reason, but not because it was young adult.
So that actually raises a related question, which is, you know, since you don't read YA, you clearly are getting influences from someplace. So who would you say are some of your writing influences?
Oh, yeah, that's wide ranging and it really depends, what I'm doing. In this case, I think a lot of the influences were just pop culture in general, because for the time period, there's like a lot of pop culture, involved with it. But I guess in general, I was trying to figure out a response to maybe magic realism, because magic realism is seen, is represented most notably, at least for English language speakers, as writers like Marquez and others of that time period, who are doing magic realism, but they're doing it in a countryside setting, in a rural setting, and it's maybe taking place like 50 or 100 years ago from now. So it's a very different experience, and I wanted to do something urban and that did not evoke those writers and that type of canon, if it makes any sense at all.
That actually does. And that was a question that I was afraid to ask about, because I know that there is some controversy about particularly any Latin American writers being associated with writing magical realism, because it's seen as sort of wiping away the sort of science fiction fantasy side of the written field, that the only way you can write quote unquote genre fiction and be taken seriously is you have to be writing magical realism. And I know that's been an on and off debate in probably the last few years. I think there was an article about it earlier this year, and it was a question I was going to ask you, whether or not you saw yourself writing magical realism, which clearly you see it as actually a kind of rejection of that label to some degree.
Yeah, I do think I write. I think that the most accurate thing to say would be that I write across boundaries, and I don't necessarily prefer one type of genre over another. I use whatever that pleases me, and whether that's using literary elements or using what might be more pulp fiction kind of elements. Lately I've been starting to do some crime writing, so that's more like thrillers and things like that, that I don't necessarily see a problem between jumping from one thing to the other. And part of that is because there's not that strict differentiation in Latin American writing as much as there is in, I would guess, in English-speaking countries, because magic realism and literature go together. We don't necessarily separate them and, you know, slice them together. But also because I have read widely from both canons, I've read as much Lovecraft as I have read famous Latin American writers like Borges and Cortázar through the years. And I do not think that I need to pick only one box. I think I can have multiple boxes. So although I was trying to experiment with doing something that was different from the canon of what we consider the traditional Latin American magic realist writers, I don't reject magic realism in general. And I have written some things in that vein in short story form. And I may go, and I can go back and forth and jump from one thing to the other. It doesn't really matter to me what something is. And I know some people have had trouble defining what this novel is, whether it's young adult or it's literary or it's fantasy. And to me, I really don't care what it is. I mean, when I was a child, my great-grandmother didn't start a story saying, well, this is science fiction, Sylvia, you know? And so we're going to treat it as science fiction. It was a story. It was a story. A story is a story is a story.
Yeah, I actually like that response. It's like, you know, is it YA or is it literary? Is it magical realism? Is it fantasy? It's like, well, it's just all of those things.
Yeah.
It seems like the response that, you know, by the time this has come out, it's probably blown over. But Ishiguro, is it Kazuo Ishiguro? Having some issues with his book being called fantasy, more particularly reviewers having some issues with his defining his book as fantasy. And it seems like the more interesting response would be like, I don't care. Like, I wrote a book, and if it's either going to be good or it's not, and if the label matters that much that you can't read it, then that sucks.
I think he fears, he does have one fear that I think a lot of us, for example, Latin American writers might share, which is that you get classified and put in a category and they won't take you out of that. Mm. Just because, you know, you get put in this box and you belong there just for, some reason that doesn't really make sense. So for example, somebody saying of me, well, she's Latin American, so she belongs in the magic realist box, and nothing she ever does can ever be like crime fiction, for example. You know, like I remember a review of one of my short stories. Somebody said it's magic realist horror, and I was like, no, it's just horror, you know. Not everything is magic realism in my life, you know, but you kind of get put in that certain box. And I think his fear, or at least what I understand it, is to be put in a certain box and for people to not be able to appreciate the work because they are kind of blinded by the description of it. And people maybe not wanting to approach the work because they think that fantasy has a certain connotation and certain values, and it must be appreciated in a certain specific way. So then nobody wants to kind of touch it. And so I understand his fear and that kind of thing. On the other hand, I think if as a society we worried less about the labels, maybe we wouldn't have these problems.
I think that's a fair point, very fair point. I also understand that fear. I know that when we interviewed Mike Cole, one of his worries is that he is never going to be able to not write the military fantasy thing, because that's mm-hmm. what he's become known for currently. And he worries about being pigeonholed as that one thing. And I know some writers do have that fear. So they'll write one series that's like one type of thing, and then that's all they're known for. So like Jim Butcher has, I think, probably had to work very hard to be known as the guy who doesn't just write the Dresden Files books, because that's what he's primarily known for. But he also has an epic fantasy series, which is supposedly really excellent. Never read it, but I've not read any of his books. I'm a bad person. I'm also a horrible human being. but I know there's that always that kind of fear. And of course it does have other kind of political implications, as kind of we're discussing here. So there's not a question there. It's just me babbling. Mm-hmm. I do that.
Yeah. And I find it kind of annoying that people sometimes have to take a pseudonym in order to write in another category. So for example, if you, write horror and you write fantasy, you have to use another name for your fantasy and another name for your horror. And to me, that seems so juvenile because, I mean, nobody told, you know, some of the great writers like Nabokov, well, you know, you can only write this, and now you got to get a pen name for this other thing because it's different from what you did before. And that just, to me, seems silly that you have to differentiate it so much that even your name cannot be on it because, oh, my God, if you write crime fiction and you write fantasy, nobody's going to be able to understand that this book is different from the other. And I'm like, what are, do we think readers are that stupid, seriously, that they can't, you know, make their own choice and decide whether they're going to read this or not? And so, yeah, I wish people would worry less about labels and categories. And then maybe we wouldn't have writers so terrified of being classified as a certain thing because, oh my God, they'll never be able to write a romance, for example, if they write military science fiction.
I always find pseudonyms really amusing because in this day of the digital age, most of the time when an author uses a pseudonym, they're pretty, they make it public, like, yeah, this is my pseudonym for this other stuff. So like, mm-hmm. it's not a secret to, and only, it's only a secret to people who aren't paying attention to that conversation or have never known anything about that author. But all of their readers are like, yeah, we know. We read his blog.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It seems kind of a, it's a thing. I don't know. Julia, did you want to jump to a question? I mean, we could talk about this topic all night because it is fun, but.
Well, I mean, we could keep talking about all sorts of things all night, but I feel like since we've run up on an hour of conversation, maybe we should think about wrapping up.
That is a fair point. So Signals to Noise is already out. So people can go buy that, and they should go buy 7,000 copies each person.
And then you should look up the playlist, which someone has put online. I think if you look for Signal to Noise playlist, you might find it. I found it by reading reviews on Goodreads where somebody actually mentioned it in the comments, and it's at the bottom of his review, which is in Spanish. So if you can't read Spanish, you won't be able to read his review, but you can actually click through to the playlist and you'll be able to understand that.
I will do people even better. I'll link to the playlist in the show notes.
Yeah, I recommend the YouTube one because you can actually see the videos. So there's like the video of Nena, which she mentions in the text and describes a little bit. And I'd never heard that song or seen that video before, and it was a little bit alarming.
Is that the one that the one that she mentions her mother thinks is obscene?
Yeah, and okay. You can understand why. Like, I could understand why. I was like, oh, yeah, I probably, like, if my mom told me not to watch that when I was a teenager, I would know why she didn't want me to watch that.
So Signal to Noise is out, but what can folks expect from you in the near future?
Well, I'm editing an all-female Lovecraft anthology right now called She Walks in Shadows, so hopefully that will be out in time for Halloween. And I've my agent has my second novel, which is also set in Mexico City, but it's completely different because it's about drug dealers and vampires in the city. So if Signal to Noise sells more than two copies, maybe we can sell this other book, and I won't have to get a pen name.
I'm already intrigued. Drug dealers and vampires, Mexico City. I'm sold.
Yeah.
And are you making any convention appearances in the next, I don't know, say 3 or 4 months?
I will be at the end of August, I will be in Rhode Island for the Necronomicon, which is the Lovecraft convention. I'll be a guest of honor there. So that's basically the only place where you will be able to catch me.
Excellent. Well, that should be fun.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Sylvia, for taking the time out of your evening to talk to us about this book.
No, thank you. It was very nice talking to both of you.
Absolutely. And thanks, Julie, for being my co-host.
Yep. Thank you for inviting me to do this interview.
Absolutely. So everybody should go check out Signal to Noise. There'll be links in the show notes and everything. So on that note, awkward ending and scene. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley. Last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.